believes that a phantasm is created within me. Here's this kind of motion, a sensation. And if I'm drawn toward it, and my appetite for it is satisfied, then that's pleasurable, and I call it good. But what I find contemptible and what I am repulsed by, I call bad. Now, we get all these phantasms. See, we've been talking about phantasms like they're individual, but as a matter of fact, we get all these phantasms coming in all the time. Okay? And some of them are drawing us, and some of them are, you know, pushing us away. And you get all the combination of these things, and the final outcome, the sum of all those phantasms, with the drawing being pushed away, you know, kind of like, y'all remember Steve Martin and Part of Me? You know, or All of Me, I guess, if that's right. You know, and he's going through this thing where he's being, you know, well, that's kind of Hobbes' view of what's going on inside you. And he says the end of that is what we call deliberation, when you finally get the net effect of all the attractions and repulsions. He says will is just the last appetite in deliberating. So then, to summarize, a voluntary act is a change that is caused by a phantasm. In the voluntary motion, a phantasm operates, but in involuntary motions in our body, phantasms don't operate. Okay. Let me illustrate. Right now, there's motion going on in my body. My heart is beating. But it's happening involuntarily. And the reason for that is that there's no phantasm, no memory, no aversion and attraction going on that's making the heart beat. But another motion takes place when I want to get a drink of water and I turn this direction, go down the stairs and find the water fountain. That motion has been caused by a phantasm, because now I have a vague recollection of water fountain and I'm drawn toward it. Okay, so this is how Hobbes distinguishes between what we do involuntarily and what we do voluntarily. Well, there's a problem with this. Well, there's more than one. It's pretty preposterous, really, because in the first place, he's saying that the difference between involuntary acts, like a brick falling through space, and my choice to go get a drink of water, is the phantasm. But of course, a phantasm, as he has defined it, is another kind of motion. It's just a particular motion, if you will, in a certain part of space, in my cortex, my brain cortex. Well, that being true, then it turns out that the difference between a voluntary and an involuntary motion is just the difference of the location of the motion. And that seems awfully arbitrary, doesn't it? That, well, if the motion takes place in the cortex of my brain, then it's voluntary. But if the motion doesn't take place there, then it's involuntary. Again, you mustn't fall back on your traditional ways of thinking things here to understand this, because you'll misunderstand the criticism. See, I might believe that I do have images in my cortex and so forth, but on my view of man, I think about those things and then I choose to go get a drink of water or not, to keep lecturing, turn on the tape recorder, turn it off, whatever it may be. And I consider that voluntary. Whereas Hobbes has taught us that the only difference between my going to get the drink of water and the heart pumping or the brick falling is that it so happens that the going to get the drink of water is a motion that's set up back here in the cortex. And that just seems utterly arbitrary. The spatial location of matter in motion is the only difference between what is voluntary and involuntary. You see, the one thing Hobbes cannot take account of is human intention. Human intention. I intend to get a drink of water. I choose to turn my body that direction, walk the steps, find the cooler, and so forth. how does my choosing, which is matter in motion, cause changes in the world outside me? Why can we say that I have chosen, say, to turn on the water fountain? Well, what we are calling choice, if we're Hobbesian, is just the way in which certain changes are experienced by me. Remember, phantasms are matter in motion, and then I experience those changes in a particular way. I experience them. But the question is, how can a way change is experienced? Put that all together. How can the way change is experienced bring about changes out there in the physical world? Say the location of the button on the water cooler. Hobbes tells us that all motion is occasioned by contact. Think of billiard balls. One hits another, and that causes change. But is my way of experiencing in contact with the button on the water cooler? No. Hobbes' own way of accounting for things, then, matter in motion, doesn't really account for how my free will changes the world, changes the position on the water cooler of that button. Because there's no contact between my way of experiencing, which he calls a phantasm, and the button on the water cooler. We've already asked the question, why should there be phantasms at all? That is the experience. Conscious experience of something. How can matter in motion experience matter in motion or be conscious of matter in motion? But another question that can be asked is, why is one matter in motion experienced psychologically as pleasurable and another matter in motion experienced as painful? Hobbes hasn't really accounted for the distinctions that we draw. In the same way that he couldn't account for why we distinguish colors and temperatures on his doctrine of phantasms, nor can his doctrine of phantasms account for why some things are pleasurable and some things are painful to us. And then a final criticism that we might offer is that Hobbes, in the end, is trying to account for our deliberations and our choices and our behavior in terms of something that is like billiard balls hitting each other. But the problem we have philosophically is that when we look at human behavior, it's not that we don't see billiard balls, mind you, but what we're looking at in human deliberation and choice doesn't seem to be anything like billiard ballness. It doesn't seem to have that kind of mechanicalness to it, but rather intentionality and personality that Hobbes has not accounted for. Well, what happens to the realm of values on this theory of human psychology? Well, all values prove to be subjective, don't they? To say something is good is just to say you're drawn toward it. To say that it's bad is to say that you simply are repulsed by it. Everyone, according to Hobbes, aims at his own good, which is just to say, aims to do what brings pleasure. But what causes pleasure to you may be different than what causes pleasure to me, right? One man's meat is another man's poison, as we say. What is it that's generally true about all human beings? According to Hobbes, people may have different pleasures and different pains, but everyone is driven competitively seeking pleasure and glory. He said, though you may have different particular pleasures and pains than your next door neighbor, nevertheless, both of you have this in common, that you are competitive, realizing that you want to get what you want and you're seeking your own glory, you're ambitious, if you will, and ambition cannot be satisfied if it doesn't, keep others with their ambitions from intruding on you getting the things you want. What is Hobbes saying about man? I think this is funny because I really detest the philosophy of Hobbes, but usually when I hear humanists talk about Hobbes, the one part he got right is what they hate. Hobbes said men are not fit to live together because they all want their own way. They're all driven for glory and to satisfy their own pleasures, and they're competitive. They don't want the ambitions of others to get in the way. And so Hobbes' political theory needs to account for how we can live together in community when everybody's just, in their natural impulses, in competition with one another. Everybody's ambitions getting in the way of everybody else's ambition. How can there be peace in society when men are temperamentally unfit to live together? Well, let's say that we propose as Reformation thinkers that the way in which men have their natural aggressiveness and ambition and egocentrism tamed is by religion. Is Hobbes going to buy this? Nope. That doesn't mean Hobbes didn't have views about religion. It's just that he didn't think religion had any kind of objective reality. Hobbes did recognize that religion is one of the psychological drives of men. But according to Hobbes, what we call religion really has to be analyzed further as just the combination of self-interest and fear. Self-interest and fear. Now, what did I say earlier about Hobbes' view of the Puritan Revolution? Are these people really appealing to God as their king and why the earthly king must now, be judged or rebuked because he doesn't live up to? No. Their religion is just their own self-interest. And so his cynicism about the Reformation in England ties in very well, you see, with his total philosophy, that religion doesn't have any objective truth. It's just a psychological matter where people are trying to get their own way or they are fearful of something. Now, if you let people have all these different religions in society, then you're not going to have peace in society. According to Hobbes, the only safe thing to do is to make sure that opinions and doctrines are rigidly controlled by the civil magistrate. Hobbes even felt that in many cases, the superstitions of the masses, though they might have some value, would have to be controlled by the magistrate so that they don't have competition between these somewhat valuable superstitions. You don't want religious people bringing social reform because what they're going to bring is anarchy and civil war. What you have to do, finally, according to Hobbes, is suppress the opinions of dissidents. Hobbes thought that the fears that lie behind religion are different from other kinds of fears people have, say of lightning or of drowning or what have you, in that the other fears have a good reason for them. Religious fears are all irrational. Well, why do people choose one religion over another? Why do they choose Roman Catholicism over Protestantism, over Hinduism, what have you? Hobbes said, well, it's completely subjective. One man's meat is another man's poison. And so you can't allow people to debate their religious differences to find the truth. There is no truth in religion. Religious truth must simply be what the political sovereign dictates. The only difference between religions, therefore, is political. Which one has the power to impose its will on the others? Religion is just subjective feeling. It doesn't have to be debated as to truth. And so all choices in religion come down to what does the civil magistrate dictate. So this brings us to Hobbes' view of the state. Hobbes has already given us this very depressing view of human nature as aggressive, ambitious, selfish. Men are not fit to live in community with one another. How do we prevent one another from being destroyed? How can you get all these selfish, naturally at war people into a kind of a lawful and orderly society? According to Hobbes, the only way to do it is by everybody surrendering their natural freedom to pursue whatever they want, which is get you into trouble because then you run afoul of everybody else who's acting freely. Everyone surrenders their natural freedom to a single individual who will be their sovereign. That is, human societies need an all-powerful sovereign to compel them to do what the sovereign says, so at least whatever they do is unified. Now, Hobbes has already taught us that there is no right and wrong in ethics, and there is no right and wrong in religion. That's all subjective preference. So all he's getting at when he says this is that you need a Leviathan, an individual who will at least regiment everybody to the same rights and wrongs and the same religion. But he's not regimenting them as to what is objectively true, objectively right, or what is just. Now this ought to chill your bones. Here you have somebody saying, when all is said and done, right and wrong are simply what the dictator says they will be. And that's the only way you can have peace in society, because if you let people debate things and have their own subjective opinions, their own ambitions, then they just destroy each other. So Hobbes says, if you let everybody think these things through on their own, you get anarchy. The answer to anarchy is to have a dictator, a Leviathan, a beast. And the dictator is not a good dictator because he does what is morally good. The dictator is good simply because he's efficient in unifying all of the people in the society so that you don't have anarchy. Now here's a tough question for you. If morality is subjective and religion is subjective, and if the laws of nature are only a description of the way things actually work, either in the natural world or in the psychology of man, then on what basis does Hobbes recommend to us that we should give up our natural freedom to a dictator? Let that sink in for a minute, because I just cut Hobbes off at the knees philosophically. Because you see, what you don't seem to realize when you write a political theory like this is that you're writing what people ought to do. Well, why should they choose to go with Leviathan? Well, Hobbes might argue this is a law of nature now, not prescriptive, just descriptive. He might argue if you don't go along with Leviathan, then you're going to have anarchy, and that's not comfortable for you. Yes, but why should I care whether it's comfortable for me or not? Am I under some kind of obligation to seek peace in society and to avoid anarchy? At this point, Hobbes might say, well, there's this natural law of psychology that we are repelled by pain. If you have anarchy, you have pain, so you are repelled by pain. That's why you should go for the Leviathan. Ah, but you see, in trying to answer himself, he's been reversed the other way, because if, as a matter of natural fact, I'm repelled by pain, anarchy brings pain, then I don't need somebody recommending that I go with Leviathan. I just do it naturally, don't I? But what has he said? Men don't naturally get along. They fight with each other. They're ambitious and greedy and self-centered. And so here he has a description of man's ethical dilemma, to use Reformed conceptions. And he's giving us, in his view, and we think it's horrible, he's giving us his messianic salvation for man's problem. And his Messiah is who? Leviathan, the beast. But in the process of laying this out, he is telling us we ought to get rid of our selfishness and surrender to Leviathan. But since all ethics is subjective, Hobbes can't tell us that we ought to do it. He can't tell us we ought to do it in terms of his law of nature, which is descriptive, and he can't tell us we ought to do it in terms of some moral prescription of which there is none. So what is this all about, finally? It's a self-contradictory theory of politics. Yeah, I want to convince all of you that, so we live on the same block together. I want to convince all of you that it's for your good to give up some of your freedoms so that we have a block captain or somebody who's going to rule over us. We need to choose somebody who's the biggest bully on the block, and that big bully is going to keep us in line. Okay, so you have the proposal come to you and you're thinking it through. So now, why do I want a bully to rule over me? And so you come back to me and say, Dr. Munson, I'm not sure. Why are you proposing? I mean, I don't particularly like that guy over there. Why are we going to let him be the block captain? And here's my answer. Let me you tell me if you find this persuasive. Because if you don't give up your freedom to the bully, then you might always be subject to bullies getting in your way. Isn't there something terribly ironic about this theory? What's the problem? Why is the state of nature troublesome to me? Well, I go about doing all the things I want. I'm ambitious. I'm self-centered. I want to get things done. And then I find out that there's somebody else out there who wants the same thing I do, and he's bigger than me, and he might punch me in the nose. Hobbes says, you see, that's the state of nature. Everybody's doing his own thing. Anarchy. You're going to have somebody come along that's bigger than you and is going to bully you. You don't want that, do you? No. Well, what's the answer then, Hobbes? You need an even bigger bully to make all the bullies get along. You feeling the punch here? Doesn't that sound like he's answering the problem with more of the same problem? And of course, Hobbes can't do anything other than that because he has no Calvinistic, reformational, biblical conception of a realm of law and order beyond the civil magistrate and beyond the bullies on my block to which all men are subject. For him, the political power must be a bully because he doesn't have anything else but might to appeal to. He has no realm of right that he can appeal to. Hobbes cannot explain why we should accept the Leviathan. I mean, he can't explain the oughtness of this. And nor can he make sense of why I would want a Leviathan when the whole reason for the Leviathan is that I don't like bullies. If I don't like bullies, why would I choose a really big bully? Hobbes says that if men were enlightened enough to adopt his maxims for politics as their own, and if these maxims led to peace and security, then no absolute sovereign would be necessary. And as Hobbes grants that he can lay down certain maxims that would keep us from fighting with each other, he says, and if everyone would adopt them, these things would lead to peace and security, we wouldn't need a state at all. But, he says, men are not enlightened. They will not adopt these maxims of peace, and therefore the only choice is to bless them with tyranny. You may want to write that in your notes. I'm not quoting him, but that's what it comes down to. Men will be forced not to be free, that's a later Renaissance notion, but they will be forced to be blessed by the Leviathan. Here's another problem. What is it that we surrender to the Leviathan, according to Hobbes? Well, we surrender our freedom and we make a covenant. Or better, we make a contract with him. Now, I especially want you to see the connection between covenant and contract, because John Calvin had a covenantal view of God and also of human relationships. Hobbes has a covenantal view too, or a contractual view. But boy, there's a great deal of difference between the two covenantal outlooks. That would be a worthwhile term paper. Hobbes says we all get together and we make a covenant with Leviathan. Is Leviathan beginning to sound more and more like God, a secular God? Yeah. I don't want you to think this rhetoric that you hear from Reformed Christians in our day about how the state is made into a messiah, or the state takes the place of God, is just, you know, using language that's, you know, emotional to make the state look bad. Hobbes virtually gives the function of the covenant-keeping God to the state. The people get together and they covenant with Leviathan that he will rule them in a certain way. Well, this system is going to work only if Leviathan does what? If Leviathan keeps the covenant. Why should we ask the Leviathan to abide by the covenant? You have to understand that a covenant is only binding within the system of covenanted relationships. But what we are asking Leviathan to do is to be the one who is above the law and enforces the law. Is then the Leviathan bound by the law? Well, let's have two scenarios here. Let's say that the person we choose, the biggest bully around, to be above the law and make sure everybody abides by the law, is more enlightened than the rest of the people that he's ruling over. Well, then somebody might say, for the good of the people, Leviathan will regulate his behavior and do the right, of course we're using a Christian concept now, will do the right thing and keep his promise. Notice we appeal to a Christian concept in answering that, but even worse, you aren't allowed the premise that Leviathan is more enlightened than his fellow citizens. Because Hobbes believes that all men are venial, all men are greedy, all men are ambitious. And so we run into this dialectical problem. Hobbes must show not only that men would actually be better off under... Let me say that again. Hobbes must show not only that men would actually be better off under an absolute sovereign, he must show that they would see that they'd be better off with an absolute sovereign. But there's an internal problem here. The reason why they are better off is because they're not enlightened. They won't do things that lead to peace. But if they are not enlightened, then they won't see that they need a sovereign and be willing to accept it, because they're in darkness and greediness and so forth. So this contractual view of government, on the one hand, assumes you need the contract with the Leviathan because everybody is greedy and venial and unenlightened. But then you go on to say, and everybody will accept the covenant with Leviathan because they're enlightened enough to see it's in their own best interest. Can't have it both ways. That's a contradictory view of human nature. Or on the other hand, Hobbes, in order to prove that men would actually be better off under the sovereign, he had to make men vicious and irrational so that they're unlikely to choose the sovereign. Or, in order to show that they would choose the sovereign, he had to make them so enlightened and sensible that they didn't need the sovereign. Well, as we come to the end of our discussion of Hobbes, I think there's real value for us if we'll stop and think about the worldview of John Calvin and whether Calvin has the same kinds of problems in explaining the relationship of man to the natural order, the working of the natural order, man and his thinking ability and perceiving ability, and man and his willing ability, and then also whether Calvin is reduced to saying men must live together under a political tyrant. You see, the Reformation worldview not only can make better sense out of the world once you buy what is considered poisonous by many today, the idea of a supernatural creator who is providential and in control of everything. The Reformation worldview can make sense of the world and man and also lead to a just civil order in which men live. Or you can go with Hobbes in the modern Enlightenment, who says, no, everything is matter in motion, and then repeatedly be unable to account for the truth of human, well, the realities about humanity, about our knowing ability, our perceiving ability, our willing ability, and in the end have to put up with political tyranny, totalitarianism, because man is nothing but matter in motion. Are we going to be content by looking at the world as simply matter in motion and then accept a theory of politics that cannot incorporate value, cannot bring into consideration moral considerations like ought, prescription, right, and justice? The Renaissance worldview, with its enlightened approach, according to W.T. Jones, who is no Christian, the Renaissance worldview has this pervasive problem, the problem of finding a place for value in a world of fact. Value. Let's stop and think not just of something like ethical value, but just think of qualities, the value of blue versus red, of cold versus hot, of pleasure versus pain. Those are values. Those are not quantities. Those are values. But in the mechanistic world of the Renaissance, the materialistic world of the Renaissance, you can't make sense of qualities, can you? Nor can you make sense of consciousness over against non-consciousness, or of voluntariness over against involuntariness or mechanical automatic events. But you can't make sense of ethical value either, nor can you make sense of values in the political realm between justice and injustice. Could there be a doctrine of rights? Could there be a doctrine of rights given Hobbes' social contract? There are no rights. There's just the contract to have a bully keep everybody in line. Okay, so as Jones says, and sadly, I guess he's not been given, you know, the regenerating work of the Spirit to see where this leads. Even the unbeliever, W.T. Jones, says the pervasive problem for Hobbes and the rest of the Renaissance and that worldview is how can we bring these realms together? The answer is to begin with the presupposition that they are already together in the person of God. And God is the one who controls the facts by his sovereign decree, and in all the facts reflects the value of his character, his holiness, and his glory. And so Jones tells us, as we're getting ready to make our transition to the rest of the history of philosophy, he says the problem for the people who came after Hobbes was to show how they could accept a physical theory similar to his without being led, as he was, to conclusions that offended men's religious sense and committed them to a purely amoral and secular conception of life. How is it possible, Hobbes' successors had to ask themselves, in the neutral world of matter and motion that physics disclosed, to find a place for the reality of purpose, that is, that there's an aim or meaning here, spontaneity of human conduct, the way of speaking of free will, that we actually make choices, the significance of human life, and the validity of human thought. If the world is matter in motion, then what do we make of, get these four things written down, in this neutral world of matter in motion, why then is there any such thing as purpose, freedom, meaning or significance to human life, or validity to human thought? And according to Jones, the history of philosophy after Hobbes is a series of attempts to find a way to bring together these two sides of value and fact. And I think that's an important, helpful insight where we're going to go in our course from this point is into a lengthy and maybe exhausting study of various schools of thought now following the Reformation and the Renaissance. What I've been trying to do this week, not only am I covering a 250-year period so that we've done some historical work, but I've tried to also give you the tools for evaluating and comparing the different schools of thought that are coming. This history of philosophy course began by looking at what paganism was not able to do in answering the big questions of life. What is real? How do we know what we know? How should we live our lives? You have paganism. Then the light of Jesus Christ came into the world, and you have antithesis between the autonomy of man, humanism, and those who submit to the revelation of God, the antithesis between Christianity and non-Christian thinking. And then we come into a period in the Middle Ages where people, for some reason, are trying to synthesize, you know, pagan thinking, autonomous reason, with submission to God's revelation. And we get to the end of the medieval world, and we see a great dichotomy between theology and faith, philosophy and reason, right? These are put now in watertight compartments. The Renaissance picks up on that and wants to exploit that distinction. Does not want to bring theology in, wants to see the greatness of man. It's a revival of humanism. The Renaissance is going back to the ancient pagan way of looking at things. And the Renaissance comes out, using Hobbes as our illustration, with an utter inability to bring facts and value together. Facts and value are utterly separated, and you're stuck with the materialistic psychology of a Hobbes, its subjectivistic ethic, and its tyrannical politics. Over against humanism as the revival of the pagan autonomous spirit, you have the Reformation that's a revival of Christianity. So that original antithesis that I talked about is now reproduced in the modern world by the 1600s as an antithesis between Reformed thinking and Renaissance thinking. And I have tried to drive this in day by day. I hope I've made some points. I hope you could see in our example of Hobbes and others, by an internal critique, the problems with the Renaissance autonomous pagan approach to philosophy. Now what we're going to be doing is we're going to be tracing out the schools of thought that trail after the Renaissance. We're not going to be paying as much attention as we have here to the reformational point of view. And the reason for that is that I believe that all the difficulties we're going to be getting into have been answered already by the reformational philosophy. It's not as though people cannot improve on and advance the thought of a John Calvin. But the essential premises, which in the end are the premises that are taken from God's revelation, provide us with our worldview. But if you're going to be educated people and work, you know, self-consciously, obediently, effectively in the 20th century, you need to know something of the history of this garbagey stuff called Renaissance philosophy. I'm not teaching this to you because I want you to make a meal out of it intellectually. I'm teaching it to you so you know what not to eat, and that you might feast yourselves on what you didn't realize, but in the churches that you were raised in, and with the parents who brought you up in the Lord, they were giving you a philosophy of life that is even today the answer to all of the problems that are out there that the Renaissance has provided for us. So I've tried to make this antithesis clear. I've tried to promote why our worldview is the right answer. But next week, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be actually trampling through the garbage dump, okay? And we're going to begin by looking at the first attempt to mediate this fact-value problem, and that in the continental rationalist. We have three particular philosophers that took a rationalistic approach to developing a worldview. And what I mean by rationalism is this. I'm going to give you the key premise. We're not going to get into the details of these people, but I just want to finish my general overview of philosophy so you see it all in one picture, one panorama. The rationalists believe that there are self-evident truths from which we can deduce substantial conclusions about the way things are. Let me say it again. There are self-evident truths from which we can deduce substantial conclusions about the way things are. Why is this approach to things called rationalist? This has got to be very confusing to students who are just beginning the study of philosophy. It's confusing because the adjective rational and the term rationalism and the notion of being rationalistic are used in so many different ways. There's a sense in which Dr. Bahnsen would argue we as Christians need to be rational and not just pietistic. Now, in that sentence, I'm using the word rational in the sense that we ought to be using our intellect and not just experiencing feelings and volitions that are godly. But Dr. Bahnsen is not a rationalist, if you mean by rationalism, dependence upon man's mind as self-sufficient to answer all of his problems. I don't think man's mind is autonomous, self-sufficient. I think it needs the revelation and the regenerating work of God. But now within that school of thought that is rationalistic, meaning autonomous, there's also a school of thought, a sub-school of thought known as rationalism set over against empiricism. Am I confusing you? You following what I'm getting at? Maybe if I put it up on the board. I just don't want you to be confused when you read things, being misled by the similar sound or actual identity and form of these words. That's what we need. First of all, we have rational in the sense of intellectual, the use of the mind. And I'm saying that those who wish to be rational include, I think, Orthodox Christians. And sadly, many Christians say, oh no, we don't want to be rational. Reason's the devil's whore, after all. We just want to be pious and follow God with all of our heart and our feeling. And I disagree with that. We are rational. That's why we're studying philosophy. That's why we study apologetics, because we believe in offering reasons, being rational, using our mind. But now, there's also something known as rationalism, but I'm going to put it up here as rationalistic. To be rationalistic is to use your intellect in an autonomous way. That is, as though man's mind is cut off from God, in no need of God, and self-sufficient to get an adequate grasp of reality and guide one's life, solve one's problems. To be autonomous is to say man is all right as he is and he doesn't need God's help. And among those who are rationalistic, who are committed to rationalism in that sense, there's a number of schools of thought, but I'm just going to put two down here. One is rationalism, and that's set over against empiricism. And at the time in the history of philosophy that we are studying, on the continent of Europe, there is a general school of thought that believed, and this is the definition I just gave you of rationalism, believed that there are self-evident truths from which we can deduce substantial conclusions about the way things are. Over against rationalism, there is a school of thought called empiricism, and it is represented especially in the British Isles. So it's known as British empiricism. And British empiricism is characterized by two distinctive premises. First of all, there is no innate knowledge in man. That is, there are no self-evident truths about the world that all men know, that's innate. There is no innate knowledge in man. And secondly, only particulars exist. Only particulars exist. And I realized that many of the students in this class didn't have the ancient and medieval class, so this conflict over universals and particulars is brand new to you. So let me just do a little review with you for a second here. I hold in my hand a pen. Am I right? I think most of you can see this. There's no trick about it. Here I have a pen. But now I hold in my other hand a pen. Am I right? We have two pens here. Now, what I want to know is, when I'm referring to these things as pens, am I referring to something that is real when I mention pen? Now, I'm not talking about is this real or is this real. I'm asking whether the reference to it, them both being a pen, is a reference to something real. Is there a universal or a general class of that we'll call penness? If there is, then I can say this is an instance of penness. This is an instance of penness. And so what I'm getting at is that I have, if I were counting the furniture of the universe, I would count one pen, two pens, and then I would count some other thing called penness. So there's three things in my limited illustration here, three things that are real: the individual pens, the particular pens, and also the class of which they are members, the class of penness. Okay? People in the rationalistic, people in the rational tradition of philosophy, not rational here, but rationalism. People like Plato or Anselm in the Middle Ages, or William of Champeaux in the Middle Ages. They all believed that there was such a thing as penness or duckness, and that the individual particular things in this world are united in that they have a certain essence or nature that's been received from the class of which they're a member. And that class is real. Now, it's a tough question to say, where is that class? It's probably a muddled question to ask, where is that class? But the point is, you're talking about something objective and real, not just the subjective notion. Now, over against that view, some people said, no, when you talk about both these things being pens, you're only talking about a word that they have in common. They don't have an objective nature in common, a universal called penness. They only have the name pen in common. Okay, and that, in my estimation, is one of the weakest, stupidest lines of philosophy that you can run into. It's called nominalism. And the reason why it's stupid, just to be honest with you, is because it doesn't answer the question. It just transfers the locus of the question from things to words. Because you still have the problem of the one and the many, if you're a nominalist. Oh, it's in my hand. What is this here? The word pen. Well, what is this? It's the word pen. Now, I've put both those words up here on the board. I have a question for you. Is that the same word? Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not asking you as though you're supposed to do this semantically. Here's the philosophical problem. This is a particular, isn't it? It's a particular set of squiggles on the board. It's a particular inscription. And this is a particular, I forgot which one I was pointing at, but anyway, these are two different squiggles on the board. What I want to know is, are those two squiggles the same word? See, nominalism doesn't answer the question, it just transfers the question. What I wanted to know is, are these two things pens? Is there something of which they are really the expression, penness? Somebody says, oh no, there's no penness, there's just words. I say, okay, well then how do you account for common words? The problem comes back again. And there's another school of thought, conceptualism, that runs into the same problem, I believe, and it transfers the sameness of particulars to a psychological event in the mind called abstraction. But I want to know that when I abstract this as a pen, and there's a process going on in my mind, and I abstract this as pen, are those two processes of abstraction the same? That is, what unites the diverse abstractions into one abstraction? So the problem of the one and the many, the problem of universals, just doesn't go away, I don't believe. But now you see I've gotten prejudicial. I was just trying to explain something to you about empiricism. Let's go back to empiricism. I said British empiricism holds that there is no innate knowledge, no self-evident truths about the world. And secondly, that only particulars exist. That's the view that we call nominalism. Only particulars exist because, let's go back to the Middle Ages or to ancient philosophy. If somebody believed that universals are real, they would say the particular pens exist and the class of which they are members also exist, the class of penness, or the form or formula or concept of penness is also real. So you'd have one pen, two pens, and a third item called penness. British empiricism is the view that there's only particulars. No universals exist. So what we know by observation of particular things. So in the history of philosophy, where we are going next, we're going to be looking at a continental school of thought that says there are truths which don't have to be proven by observation. There are truths which are self-evident. But what's important about these self-evident truths, if you're a rationalist, is that from them you can deduce conclusions about the way reality actually is. You see, if you were an empiricist, you could grant that there are self-evident truths. The empiricists do. Here's a self-evident truth. A is not not A. Here's another self-evident truth. All bachelors are unmarried males. All red barns are red. There's three self-evident truths, all proven by the laws of logic. But you know what the empiricists say about those truths? They don't tell you anything about the way the world really is. You see, it could be true that all bachelors are unmarried males and there are no bachelors at all. That truth could be true if there were no men in this world. I mean, we're thinking abstractly, hypothetically. And all red barns would be red if nothing in the world was red, and if nothing in this world was a barn. You see, these truths, according to the empiricist, these truths don't tell us anything about the world. So in my definition of rationalism, I gave the troublesome point. There are self-evident truths from which we can deduce substantial conclusions about the way things really are. Not just the way we are thinking or using our linguistic terms, but about reality. The rationalist believes that I have a certain set of truths that are known to be true without observational verification, and from them I can tell you about the nature of reality. The empiricist disagrees with that. He says only particulars exist and there are no self-evident truths about the world. Way back when I taught ancient philosophy, even before we get to Plato and Aristotle, we look at the pre-Socratics, and I said, you'll notice that the pre-Socratics fall roughly into two different camps. One group of philosophers does philosophy this way. Stop and think about what you're talking about. Stop and reason about this. Okay, we see this, for instance, in Anaximander. Okay, Anaximander says, you know, there's a problem with every particular proposal people have when they say reality is this rather than that. And the problem is that even though they say it's this, there are things opposite of whatever this is that are out there as well. And so he says reality must be made up of something that doesn't have any particular quality about it. It's not a this at all. It's in Greek, a boundless something. It has no characteristic. He called it apeiron. Now, did Anaximander go out and find the apeiron and say, you know, I was cleaning out my garage and I found a can of apeiron. I think that's reality. No, he didn't go look for apeiron. He reasoned his way to his view that all reality is made up of something that has no characteristics. You see what I'm getting at? He's the guy who sits down in his armchair and he goes, now, wait a minute, let me think about this. Thales, it can't be water because there are non-watery things. And other people, it can't be air because there are things that aren't like air. Well, then what it must be, because I've reasoned through to this, is something that has no characteristics at all. That's the stop and think approach to philosophy. Stop and reflect. But another approach to philosophy says, go look and see. Go look and see. Get out of your armchair, go out the front door, and ask yourself, is that what you see when you observe the world? Now, I'm really overwriting this, but I want you to get the point. There is this traditional conflict in the history of philosophy between those philosophers